music, news, interviews, live events, and more. Welcome to the Hivecast with Matt Pinfield.
Hey, it's Matt Pinfield. It's the Hivecast. And by the way, if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can go at Matt Pinfield or on Facebook at Matthew Pinfield. Okay, so just wanted to let you know that I'm very excited about our guest today because the book that they've written has been a long time in the making, and it's one of my favorite books. And it's like, it stays in my bathroom because, and don't laugh, but it is in there. And it's one of those things that I read over a period of time, and then I took it with me on a trip, but I couldn't put it down. The book is called Louder Than Hell, The Definitive Oral History of Metal. And here with me right now are John Wiederhorn and Catherine Terman, who, of course, wrote the book. And it's good to see you guys. How are you today? Good.
We are well.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
You know, I remember when you interviewed me for the book, we were at some little restaurant like in the West Village.
Cornelius
right?
Street,
having
I
burgers,
yeah. Yeah, that was. It was amazing. And it was pretty early, too, wasn't it? Like 10 or 11 in the morning?
That was early in the process of the book
You just gotten off the air, I think, or we're just going to get on air.
Yeah,
you know, we were lucky to get you, put it that way.
So let's talk about some of the revelations that you came up with in the book. I mean, was it interesting going through your archives or doing new interviews? Was there anything particular? Let's share some of these stories with people to get their appetites wet, no pun intended, for this book. Because, I mean, it's an incredible book, but tell me some of the things that really blew your mind with some of the artists that you love.
Well, there were advantages to both the archival stuff and the new stuff. Actually, most of the interviews are brand new, so it's not just like we ran through our old clips and started ripping up, old magazine pages and cutting and pasting them Burroughs style.
Why don't we start era, like with Sabbath or something, and talk about some of that stuff?
Sure. Well, I talked to all the members of Sabbath, and Tony Iommi was amazing. He gave me 2 hours on the phone. Just for the book, actually. Plus, I had interviewed him for other places, so I had additional material, and Catherine had interviewed Ozzy, and I had interviewed Ozzy. But I'm talking to Iommi, and we're getting into the second hour, and he goes, "Oh, Christ, I've got my own book coming out. I don't know what I'm going to write about." You know, it's terrible British accent.
You know, I think the tarot card story is interesting. Like Sabbath, and of course, a lot of other bands were allegedly into the occult. And there's, of course, Jimmy Page. It's been documented. Yes, he did buy one of Aleister Crowley's estates. But I think
which tarot card incident? The one in the 60s?
The Burton one I'm speaking of.
This is really bizarre. It's a very wild story. Joe Hasselvander, who played with Pentagram with Bobby Liebling and is now in the band Raven, said that he was in this, I believe it was a studio, and there was a stack in New York. And he'd been working with Bobby, and there was a stack of tarot cards there. And they were just these wild, occult-looking things. And he took a few of them for himself because he thought this is a great collection, a collectible. And apparently the cards were cursed. So he went through, he said, years of trying to clean his house and his, his family had been touched by this. And he said everything that happened in the Amityville Horror happened in
He got these cards.
Yeah, once he had the cards in his possession where he lived, there was blood, there were flies. He said it was just terrifying, and he was able to trace it back through occult specialists and claims that they belonged to the Witchfinder General, I believe, at one point, or were involved in the whole Salem witchcraft. Someone, in a high position, maybe is the high priest of the Salem witchcraft. It's in the book, but I can't remember.
But
the Burton part is really creepy. He said the guy who picked up the rest of the cards was Cliff Burton.
Of Metallica.
Of Metallica.
Yeah,
tragically died in
the... Did he say that he pulled the death card, or...
No, he wasn't so specific, but he's convinced that the same spirits that cursed him laid it into Cliff even worse.
I mean, in the Metallica bus crash, we have Scott Ian from Anthrax talking about that because Anthrax was on tour with Metallica when the crash happened. And, basically Lars stubbed his toe. The rest of the guys in Metallica were essentially unhurt. And then their bass player and best friend is, tragically, horribly killed.
Right. They get out of the bus and they see his legs hanging on the back of the bus. I mean, it was horrific.
Yeah, and to hear Scott Ian's reaction to it, how they were told, you're touring with Metallica, and guess what? There was an accident. They're like, oh, okay, cool. They'll be a little late to the show. They're like, no, Cliff's dead. And then Scott's disbelief, and then
right,
what everyone did that night, how James was dealing with
storming through the streets, drunk out of his mind, smashing things in the middle of a foreign country. And they're like, no, dude, you're going to get arrested. You know, this is horrible, but you got to contain yourself. And he just couldn't because he was so overwrought with grief. And, you know, it's really it's a powerful moment. And that's one of the really cool things about this book is that, you know, certainly people know that story backwards and forwards, but
not
to get
the
it
mouths of the people that were there,
right?
And
exactly.
Recollections,
yeah,
to paint a bigger, wider,
and someone who arrived
picture
at the hotel an hour later and saw what was going on, and then through the voice of Lars and how he felt. It's just it was tremendous to have that kind of access and then put it together and, you know, go, wow, this is really resonates.
There are also some of the funniest moments of all time too, like you know, the Aleister Crowley, speaking of which, you know, there are bands like Eddie and the Hot Rods who put his face on the cover of their best single. Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about the Zakk Wylde story?
No, I want to talk about that. Yes,
that's great.
The best ever.
That was one
of
my favorites.
Eddie and the Hot Rods had this great single, Do Anything You Want to Do, one of the great songs of the pub rock / punk era.
Right.
And they said that their luck went down the tubes after they put Aleister Crowley on the cover of this 45 with a Mickey Mouse ears
oh,
on.
Yeah, yeah. Of
so they said,
I
like, all
that.
Their fortunes went south. But the funniest thing is the Ozzy story with Zakk Wylde. Let's where he goes, oh, that's what that cunt looks like.
Yeah.
And he loves this song, Mr. Crowley.
Right, right.
This whole song about him. So tell us. Go ahead.
Well, it's so funny. I was talking to Zakk, and he said that they were in New York, and he wanted to go to this occult bookstore, The Magical Child, because he'd heard about it, and he wasn't particularly a collector in cult books. But Zakk was,
yes.
Yeah. Not Ozzy at all, but he brought Ozzy along. So Zakk Wylde is there in the store with Ozzy, and he's like looking through, you know, old manuscripts and all these things. And then he sees a poster of Aleister Crowley. He's like, huh, that's kind of cool. How much is that? And the guy behind the desk says, that's $6.66. He goes, oh, you're fucking kidding me. He's like, here's $7. Keep the change. So he puts it up in their practice space where they were working on new material. And Ozzy goes, Zakk, who's that guy over there?
Who's that
bald-headed
bald-headed cunt. It's like, you're kidding me, right? It's like, no, you got this poster. Who's this bloke? It's like, Oz, you're joking. You're pulling my leg, right? You've been singing about this guy for 20 fucking years. That was Aleister Crowley. And of course, Zakk tells a story with so much flair.
And Ozzy goes, oh, that's what that
fucking cunt looks like.
It was not Mr. Tinker Train.
That is hilarious.
Yes.
That's one of the greatest, you know, it just goes, well, Sabbath were the first to say that they were never into the occult. You know what I mean? And that, you know, that was their whole thing. But man, did they make scary music when you were a kid.
Exactly. If you wanted to be in the occult, the music would help you right along.
But they're another one of those bands that were into the occult at one point. They dabbled, and then that's what the song Black Sabbath is, in fact, is about, because Geezer Butler had this visitation at the front of his bed while he was lying sleeping, and he's like, oh my God, and he said that, you know, this apparition kind of looked down at him, and he got the feeling that it was sort of the point of no return. Either he continued doing what he was doing and writing sinister music, or he kind of changed his lyrical focus and then maybe not face the eternal repercussions that awaited him. but then he said it scared the hell out of him. And that's why in the lyrics it says, what is this figure that stands before me, a figure in black that points at me, turn around quick and start to run. You know? So, he said after that, the head witch of England, the White Witch, told them to not wear upside-down crosses anymore, to turn their crosses right side up, so that they would then be on the side of the good witches
and don't
the
burn
good
them into
spirits.
Your forehead like Glenn Benton.
That's right. There's a good story about that in the book. He almost went into a vein and pierced some major.
Glenn Benton has an upside down cross right in the middle of his forehead. For anyone who doesn't know, and it's not a good look, kids.
Which he burned into his forehead with costume jewelry. Just heated it up. Maybe a half a dozen times and more.
He said. It's like a jailhouse tattoo.
Pretty much.
Yeah. A lot of interesting characters.
Now, what about Axl and you know, Guns N' Roses? Let's talk a bit about that.
Well, you know, it's...
Did you know Axl when he, before, like, the band started when he, or maybe, the, actually, they were already together.
Well, actually...
But when he was working at the Tower Records video store across from Tower Records on Sunset?
Slash was working there, yeah. Well, the yeah.
Or was Slash there and Axl?
I think so. Slash,
I thought Axl was...
Too. Slash definitely told a story about how he was working there. He used to work at a newsstand also, which was cool because they got all the music magazines.
Where, like, but, Laurel Canyon and I...
I think it was at Melrose and Fairfax.
Okay.
Yeah, quite a popular celebrity, frequented newsstand in the day. But I know Slash had said he'd like ripped off some videos or something. And then when Guns N' Roses became famous or whatever, he was always afraid he was going to go into Tower Records. They'd be like, you used to work for us and you stole videos. You're under arrest. So, yeah, they were definitely all, I mean, Slash was an L.A. native. I actually met them before Guns N' Roses because, oddly enough, Duff McKagan, I met him when he first moved to L.A.
And from Seattle,
and he joined my boyfriend's band.
What was the name of your boyfriend's band?
Oh, we can skip that one.
Okay. So you don't want to give him any love? You're like, enough of that.
Yeah.
Don't give me points.
But Duff was 20, and he was already sober at the time because he'd already had, you know, big drinking. He was sober. And he also couldn't get into some clubs because he was only 20. I remember going to the Coconut Teaser trying to get in with him. And then eventually, you know, we used to hang out. He had an apartment in this building called the Nirvana, of all things. Like a lot of old apartment buildings, even in L.A., have names like they do in New York. And he had...
Like the Gaines Ward.
Yes, exactly. He had one crappy...
Post Towers.
Yeah, he had a crappy little single room. And then, you know, he joined Guns N' Roses. And I remember him, you know, bringing us Appetite and playing at a friend's house. But I got to go into the studio while they were doing that.
Making that record.
Yeah, just
what do you remember specifically about the recording of that record?
Well, I remember, actually, it's funny. I remember more about the interview because the day of the interview, like at 9 in the morning, Slash called. And I think I saved it on my machine because who's up at 9 except for Slash? Apparently, you know, when you drink a whole lot, you tend to wake up early.
So Slash still was, drunk from the night before.
Exactly. So Slash was like, hey, when you come to the interview, bring us Jim Beam. So I went to the studio in the Valley. I can't remember what it was called. I think... yeah, I don't remember what it was called at the time, but the whole band was there and none of them had cars. So I had to give them all rides home after the interview. And when Steven Adler and I were going over Laurel Canyon, this was, I guess maybe this, obviously the time frame was a little different. I guess the single had come out already, but we actually heard Welcome to the Jungle on the radio, like for the first time when Steven Adler was in the car and he was air drumming like on my dash. It was really a cool moment. So
That's
I saw
awesome.
Them a lot before they were signed at the Troubadour, at the Music Machine, and Axl was normal.
Yeah, it was a funny story, you know, because Greg Dooley was telling me, the Afghan Wigs, that he was working at the record store on Sunset.
Mm-hmm. Tower Sunset.
He'd moved to L.A. before he moved back. You know, moved back to Cincinnati. He'd lived in L.A. for a little while when he was young. And he said Axl was working across the street at Tower Video for a while, so maybe he and Slash both had worked there.
Every musician in L.A. worked there at some point.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It was the only place that would hire degenerates.
Yeah, which is good.
Oh, yeah. Every city needs a place like that. I don't know. Motor City might be the place here or some bar. I don't know.
Yeah, but I think it's fantastic when you think about that. And I remember Greg saying, you know, at first, he said, Axl had an attitude, but he said when he went to see Guns N' Roses play, he said he knew they had it. They were great no matter what, and that was the thing. So
yeah, I think everyone felt that. I mean, in those days, like in Louder Than Hell, one of the photos that is getting the most attention is Axl in the buttless chaps with the like leather G-string, and his hair is, you know, 10 feet high.
Like it was in the Welcome to the Jungle.
Exactly, and he used to wear like the ball gag around his neck, as you know, the red ball gag is... jewelry or whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, they definitely had it in those days. They were the band to beat and no one really could.
Absolutely. What about anybody else in particular, like any Metallica stories, other ones other than the bus crash that in particular you think people would really find interesting in here?
Sure, yeah. The whole story about how Metallica came to New York, you know, they were originally an LA band. Some people don't realize that. They weren't based out of the Bay Area.
They went down there, but they hated the whole hair metal thing.
They didn't succeed in L.A. Yeah, no one really liked them or got what they were doing, and they were, you know, playing faster than everybody else, and thrash metal hadn't really been discovered yet. Cause
they were listening to the new wave of British heavy metal, and
right,
they were listening to punk.
Right. So fast forward, Metallica are making some waves in L.A., but not really. So they moved to San Francisco, record this demo, No Life to Leather, which was, you know, back in the days of tape trading, before you had MP3s, everybody would put their recordings on cassette tapes and then send them through the mail through this network of metal fans because no magazines wanted to pick up this music. No, there was no radio play for it. There was nothing.
It's like the Stone Age.
Yeah. But there was a very strong underground tape network. And one of the guys who got hold of this tape was a guy named Johnny Zazula.
From, of course, the
Megaforce.
Megaforce, right.
Rock and Roll Heaven was his store.
Store in East Brunswick at the Route 18 mall. And not Route 18 mall, the Route 18 flea market.
Did you
the
hang
flea
out
market,
there?
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up in that town.
Oh.
I grew up in East Brunswick. So, yeah, I went there and I went by that. So it was there were two places you went. You went there. There was also a punk like stand there that this guy ran. It had like all punk singles and buttons and T-shirts. So it was punk and metal there.
And everyone hung out. Scott Ian used to hang out there all the time. And
the metal patches and the punk pins side by side.
Yeah,
and
that's
so,
really where it was.
So Johnny Z gets this this tape, No Life to Leather, and he's playing it for everybody. He's like, "This is incredible." He plays, and then he's like, "You know what? I'm going to bring these guys to New York. I'm going to start a label, and I'm going to sign them." And he tells this to Scott Ian one day, and Scott's like, "You're going to what? You can't just start a label. How do you start a label?" He's like, "I don't know, but I'm going to do it. You know, this is great. This is great. This is the new thing." And so, you know, this just shows how amazing and trusting and naive everyone was back then. He sent Metallica $1,500, said, "Get from San Francisco to New York. I'll put you up. I'll get you, you know, the recording gear and time that we need, and we'll get a record done." So Metallica pile into a U-Haul, two of them in the very back of the U-Haul, and imagine Mustaine back there with them too.
There
was probably a little bit of complaining from several members. So in any case, they make the haul all the way here, and they're told, "We're going to put you in the music building. That's where Anthrax play. You know what? We're going to give you their room because you don't have a place to stay. You'll be able to live in the music building in Anthrax's practice room." They're like, "This is probably a great place." You know, they're thinking like SIR Studios or some like deluxe accommodation. And what it really is basically just a shell of a building that had practice rooms that bands would play in. They'd pay a minimal amount of money and they could play all day long. This was in Queens. So they get there and the owner of the building says, no, you can't live here. Nobody can live here. It's like, what are we going to do with Metallica? They have no place to stay. It's like, well, we'll let them stay on the roof in a shed. We have a shed there, so they could stay there until they find something else. So
yeah, Metallica lived on a storage shed on the roof. Apparently, you know, I don't know what they did for hygiene.
What did they do to take a dump? Or,
yeah, I don't
know. No, Anthrax lent them a toaster and let them do their laundry. Well, I don't know if they did laundry, but in any case, yeah, they were very helpful to them in the way early days, but. Scott Ian says it was just an amazing thing to watch this band from the very early days because he said they just had it. And watching them rehearse, they'd play in a circle, whereas most bands would kind of line up and just kind of jam. But they'd be able to make eye contact and watch each other and connect these songs. And he said that everything they did with the early material that ended up on Kill 'Em All was just magical. And then, of course, Mustaine got booted from the band. And there's some interesting stories. Well, you know, he was and remains a great talent. But at the time, Mustaine had this angry streak and they never knew how he was going to react. And it got to the point where they were the only ones living in the music building. And Dave would get drunk. And this is according to Scotty, and Dave didn't tell me this. Scott did. But Dave would pick up trash cans and dump them in front of the doors of bands he didn't like. And of course, Metallica was the only one staying there, so everybody knew who did it. And you know, they were developing a bit of a bad reputation. They didn't want to get kicked out, and they really wanted to have some stability. So they made a very difficult choice, and ultimately decided to kick Dave out of the band. And one of the photographers who contributed to our book, Kevin Hodapp, is a New York-based guy, and he was shooting a lot of early Metallica stuff. And he said he showed up one day, and he was going to do a shoot with the band. And Lars took him aside and said, "Kevin, you know, let's keep Dave out of these shots." He's like, "What do you mean? He's part of the band." He's like, "Well, just between us, he's not going to be part of the band for too much longer." So
now, you know, the hair metal thing owed more of itself. I mean, originally, at least look at everything, to 70s glam that had come from the UK, a lot of that stuff, and some of the American bands. You know,
definitely.
We talk about Mark Bolan, T-Rex, Slade, you know, some of the Bowie stuff. You know, Mata Hoople, I mean, but it took it in a different direction. Let's talk about the stuff.
The Suite, for sure.
Suite were great, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the
love
them. When I met Kevin DeBrow at the VH1 Rock Honors, we had never met. First of all, I didn't know how tall he was. But he was a super sweet guy. And we talked about Suite. Mm-hmm. The funny thing was, he said, I covered Slade. It was our manager's idea. He goes, I was never a Slade fan. But, of course, it made them famous. It gave him a number one album and actually launched the whole hair metal
thing. That story is actually in our book about how, I think it was Spence Proffer, maybe their producer or manager guy who wanted them to do it. And Kevin was very against it. The rest of the band was like, eh, whatever. And so, you know... The manager producer kept saying, is the song ready? Are you guys ready to record it? What's going on? They're like, yeah.
But yeah, they just kept blowing him off.
They did nothing about it.
They never learned it, right? Until
never
like
learned
right
it,
when
never
they
learned
it.
Exactly. And really, it's Frankie Benelli, I believe, the drummer who I interviewed. And he said he just had Frankie himself had such a work ethic, he couldn't play the song badly. So when Spencer Proffer was sitting there, you know, all right, let's hear what you have. Frankie had to play it well for his own,
that
you know,
drum intro.
Exactly, yes, and so Kevin was kind of singing along, but like glaring at Frankie, like, "Hey, we're not supposed to do this song well. What the hell are you doing?" But you know, apparently, I think that might have been the take they used.
They used the take, like they had made an agreement before that they were going to purposely screw it up and they were going to laugh at each other while they were doing it and make faces. But it just came off as you know, this magical recording, and of course catapulted them to stardom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I used to see them. They were, there's several, as with many bands in LA, there were many versions of.
You know, it was MK1, MK2.
Exactly,
you know?
It's like Deep Purple. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
maybe not that big a revolving door, but I mean, obviously, Randy Rhoads was the initial Quiet Riot guitarist, and Kevin and Randy were very, very tight. And then, of course, he left for Ozzy, and then that was kind of then the band turned into just calling themselves DeBro, because Kevin didn't want to call it Quiet Riot without Randy. But then Mark III came along, and they turned back into DeBro, and this is the, you know, the one that carried on for years and had success, even though they eventually did kick Kevin out of his own band.
And what was that for? Was that because
I feel also much like Dokken, you know, George Lynch and Don Dokken had a very contentious relationship. I think Kevin had a contentious relationship with other members of his band, and I don't know what the final straw was, but at a show, they left him in Hawaii and the band left and they're like, you're out of the band. He's like, what? It's my band. I can't be out of it. But and anyway,
recently with the Stone Temple Pilots, you know, battle between Scott and Eric, you know, over that.
And now Chester Bennington is singing with both bands,
Mark and them. So, you know,
there's a sort of singers. I mean, like, look, Velvet Revolver. I mean, they have a record deal, superstars, but they can't find a singer. That there seems to be. You know, every singer's doing double and triple duty.
Finding a singer with real personality and talent.
Yeah,
where? In front of a band that has that kind of...
Exactly.
You keep thinking, when is Miles Kennedy just going to step up and say, okay, I'll do it?
Yeah, I mean, I know. It's funny. It really is.
Yeah, it is crazy. But yeah, it's we mentioned earlier, sadly, a lot of L.A. guys had died. But actually, during the making of our book, during the writing of Louder Than Hell, I think we counted at least 10 or 11 people passed away.
No, let's talk about those 10 people.
Oh,
I mean, of course,
it was so sad.
Sadly, I mean, Ronnie James Dio, of course, he was just...
But that was cancer, which was...
Yes,
you know.
Mm-hmm. It was. I mean, very few were from diseases, I guess. Most of them were
drug-related,
of long-term drug abuse, not necessarily an overdose, though I believe Kevin DeBrow, he was.
Paul Gray, he died of a drug overdose from Slipknot.
Janie Lane, I believe, sadly, was... acute alcohol intoxication. I don't know if it was one of his last interviews, but I interviewed him a year and a half or so before he died, and he was just really sweet and humble, and it was kind of sad in the same way that you know, Dokken fought over money. I guess they did as well, and they started calling him, like, what was it, like
95% Hitler. He told me that story. It's
Thank
in your
you.
Book. I got that from your book.
Excellent. See, you know it better than I do.
I really read it. You know, it's,
see,
you know,
I didn't
it's not
really
bullshit.
Write it, though.
A lot of guys will tell you they read your book and not. They'll read like the
I know,
the
exactly. Button. So, I mean, I felt a lot of sadness from him.
Because what happened was he said in the book that he had actually, they were all away, and he arranged their parts for the songs on the album. So when he gave them to him, you know, he really felt like he wrote the songs he wanted that much of the publishing. So they put that little piece of paper up on the mic stand, 80% Hitler.
That's
the contention started at that point.
I mean, I can see that it's funny, and I see the band's point of view, but it's also very sad, and I see everyone's
really
side.
Sad story, too, was the dying Mike Starr dying, you know. know, from Alice in Chains. Yeah. I thought that was bad. You know, really pissed me off to no end was, you know, people are so hungry to, like, you know, listen into other people's pain and agony that one of the last phone calls that Mike Starr had made to cop some drugs or whatever, an 8-ball mm-hmm. or something, somebody had taken that voicemail and put it up online. And I was upset and appalled
by
it.
That's sickening.
It was sickening because, you know, you see this person who's obviously suffering from a disease of addiction in a big way. And then they're playing this thing where he's like, obviously, you know, at the time, you know, really desperate. And also, mm-hmm. you know, at that point, you know, probably trying to use the fact that he, you know, was in a very famous band. So they would know it was him. So they'd call him back. It was just sad. I was pissed off.
Sure.
Because it was before RXP, my radio station here in New York City, right. was sold. And my producer played it for me. He goes, look, so this thing that came up. And I was just like, I would never, ever, ever, ever play a second of that on my radio show mm-hmm. or yeah. acknowledge its existence. Because, of course, I'm acknowledging it here, but that's just because I was angry.
Right, right. Well, it's the age of sensationalist media where anything
TMZ,
goes.
TMZ, you know, yeah. they seem to, they're probably listening in on us right now. You know, this is probably.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, it's amazing how many people, I mean, not that Alice in Chains were lumped in. Even when they started, they looked glammy, obviously, when they first started out before the whole.
Definitely. They were, you know, big hair. Actually, we had a chapter in the book, a grunge chapter that we wrote, and we had a lot of archival stuff because, you know, I've interviewed Kurt Cobain and Dave Grohl and all those guys back in the day.
Tell me some. Why don't you tell us?
Well, we actually cut that chapter from the book because we had, maybe you can voice in on the debate, you know, like our book is over 700 pages, louder than hell, heavier than hell. And it would have been about 900 pages, but we had to cut some stuff and it hurt us. But we're like, all right, we will cut the entire grunge chapter because it's not strictly metal, even though Soundgarden and Alice in Chains certainly elements of metal in the early days, influenced by Sabbath, Melvins, you know, a lot of those guys, big metal fans, and it seeps into their music. But we did, you know, clearly Pearl Jam, not metal, Nirvana. But I mean, Kurt Cobain talked a lot about reading Cream magazine, and I think it was Chris Novoselic.
And Dave Grohl said they used to drive in the van and listen to Celtic Frost.
Right,
and,
so and, that's one thing. I mean, even though it's a history of metal, our book, I thought, oh, you know, we can include this because they talk about metal. They were influenced by metal, even though they're not Iron Maiden or, you know, Judas Priest or something. But we did cut that chapter, but I think that may be excerpted other places. But a lot of people say grunge killed metal. And what they're referring to is hair metal. And, you know, instantly it was off MTV, sort of, and replaced by Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know.
Yeah, the Nirvana Bulldozer, they call it.
Yeah.
And there's some great stuff in the book about the whole evolution of nu metal. And some people thought that shouldn't be included, and that's not really metal. But it was. It was, at the time, the loudest, the heaviest, the most aggressive, and Korn was undeniable. Cold Chamber, Deftones, even Limp Bizkit, whether you love them or hate them, played such an important role in the lives of a lot of kids who, you know, were getting out this aggression and listening to this music and screaming along.
And picking up instruments.
Yeah, yeah.
That all the bands were helping each other then, you know, the Korn was
you know, I mean, I'm quoted
up.
In the book as saying, you know, that at the time, because, you know, it was part of the evolution, we had a longer conversation. And I'll mention this now, too, because, you know, I was friends with Limp Bizkit and Korn, of course. I mean, I remember being one of the first people, the only people in the MTV music department to give people like Manson and Korn and all these other people a thumbs up to get their videos on MTV back in the day.
Good for you.
And I remember Korn even saying to me, I remember Jonathan and Fieldy both in tears when they got their first gold record downstairs at Roseland. The place was packed going mad for the Life is Peachy tour. They come out and they'd done Twist and Chi and all the stuff. And of course, Chi, the song named after Chi, who we just lost from the Deftones, was named after him because they said, man, that bass line sounds like something that Chi would play. Let's call the song Chi, which is a great song. But I remember them looking at me and going, we know you're the only guy over there who really gets us, man, and who's all at our back, and we just want to say thank you because I really did like them. You know what I mean? And on the other thing that I'm quoted in your book, there's a couple really classic moments in there, the one with Manson where I knew it was time to put the brakes on my partying because Manson looked at me. I'm downstairs in Roseland. Mm-hmm. It was Radiohead had just finished their encore. And there used to be this labyrinth of the Roseland where people would go in this, you know, it was probably from the 20s and during speakeasies and Prohibition.
So cool.
You'd go back into that room and people would drink and get high. And I just remember Manson and Twiggy, and Manson looks at me and goes, Pinfield, you scare us. Now, if I scared Manson, I knew it was time to take a break. And, of course, shortly after that, I was I had to.
That's such an awesome story.
It made sense. You know, it's a joke.
Yeah,
it
had to be in the book.
It's a fun story. Made the book. The other one was that I kind of want to elaborate a little more on was because, you know, I mentioned the thing with Fred where Fred fell out with a lot of the artists
Fred
that
Durst,
he helped
right.
out. Like, you know, like with Stained and Korn helped him out. But, you know, that was by no means, you know, me dissing Fred because I had good memories with Limp Bizkit. Mm-hmm. I mean, and with Fred, I was on Significant Other on that hidden track on the end of that thing. And at one point, it was one of the most quoted things on AOL by teenagers.
Wow.
They took my rant, which I wrote in a cab, because Fred originally said to me, hey, why don't you diss us on the end of this record? I'm like, dude, you already did it on the Korn record. You and like Jonathan are hating each other and All in the Family. I go, that would just be the same thing. Let me do something else. So I just wrote a thing about, you know, the boy bands and people that don't write their own songs. And I went off on a tangent. It was like all an acted script. We did it at Southern Tracks. They brought me down there to Brendan O'Brien's studio.
Nice.
And we threw mic stands around, so it sounded like I was really breaking up the place. And
that's awesome.
Fred goes, Pinfield's fucking pissed. And people love that track. The guy in Mumford & Sons told me it scared the shit out of him when he was a kid,
that's
which
so
was
awesome.
Classic. Because he loved that record. He goes, it was my first album.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, and it scared me. But, you know, look, that's the only thing I want to say that I would have elaborated on a little more than what it says in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I by no means am dissing. I mean, I had some great memories with those guys. I'm in the Rearranged video. I played the judge who sentenced them to death. So I have some good memories with them. But, you know, I was just making a matter of fact that things got crazy in that whole scene. And Fred did fall out with a lot of those bands.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that at this point that they've reconciled and they're all friends again.
Actually, yeah, Fred's been doing some interviews recently and kind of talking about how overblown things had become and, you know, selling 12 million copies of an album when you're at that age on your second, Significant Other was the second record?
Yeah, it was the second record, yeah.
It just completely, you know, goes to your head. And they were like kids in a candy store. None of them were in serious relationships. Well, some of them weren't. There were lots and lots of women who wanted to be with them because they were, everywhere on the radio, and they all had a field day with everything that they'd ever possibly imagine, and that's part of the whole mythology of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But it also goes to your head, and I think a lot of these guys develop insane egos, and I think Fred will admit that he was spinning out of control at one point, through having a little distance now and perspective and being able to put the band back together and being a little more humble now and getting along with, West Borland.
It's good to see those guys working.
Yeah, I think
out.
Fred sometimes Hopefully. is too forthcoming. I mean, he wears his heart on his sleeve a lot and he doesn't seem to realize, or he didn't used to seem to realize, yes, there would be a backlash, but...
And I think that was the thing that I made in the comment. That was what I was trying to say. Was,
sure.
You know, that
right.
because... You know, whenever you're have that level of success, there's definitely going to be people gunning for you. And then when you also piss people off and you're kind of just, have a disregard at the moment, then people are super gunning. My comment was more on how the way that people had reacted to rap rock. They wanted to throw dirt on it at that period in time
mm-hmm.
because, of some of the things that had happened and some of the excess that they had seen. But hey.
But also he went on TRL at every opportunity, and that's a no-no if you're a metal band. And he said he was, having a relationship with Britney Spears. And it's what a way to lose, your cred. And it's amazing that he got it back.
He had some love with Christina as well. I mean, I don't know who.
Equal opportunity lover.
Me, I have never touched Fred.
Yeah, it's an interesting time all the way around. I mean, look, Jonathan was married to, or maybe he wasn't married to her. He was living with Devin, the porn star.
Isn't he still married to her?
Is he?
I think so. I think they have kids together.
I know they have
was
kids.
That the first? I know he's had two wives.
You got to. Hey, how about this? You got to love a guy, Jonathan Davis, who names his kid Zeppelin.
I know.
I mean,
I think
it's like the guy, Mike Dirnt in Green Day named his son Brixton after the Clash song, The Guns of Brixton. In tribute to Paul Simon in writing that incredible.
And I believe Tom Morello's, maybe one of his son's middle name is Rhodes, spelled like Randy Rhodes.
Yeah.
Your kids don't have names like that?
Well, one of them's right here. Jessica Lynn is her name. So
she's
pretty
not named after the Allman Brothers song, Jessica?
No, but I always did tell her about that song.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a great instrumental. You know what I mean?
There aren't very many Catherine songs, so if anyone wants to write one, I'm up for it.
Her sister's name is Maya, so you know what I mean?
Oh.
But they're not really songs, are they? They're just good names, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, it's no Apple or Inspector Gadget or whatever, but it's okay.
Inspector Gadget? Whose name is that?
No, it was, I think it's Pilot Inspector, I believe, was the name. Not Inspector Gadget's a cartoon, but
I know it
might
is.
As well.
Christ, they made DC Go-Go records after that, you know? Speaking of being in the DC scene, did you know Stephen Blush back then, who does the American Hardcore book and all that stuff? Did you know him?
I actually didn't meet him until I came to New York, but
yeah. We were high together.
Oh, that's wild. That's wild.
I remember when he was touring with one of the DC bands, punk bands, No Trend, that he managed. He would be in this old gutted ambulance, and he would come up to New Brunswick and, you know, come hear me spin. And there's a little chapter about the melody in American Hardcore. But we would take that ambulance to every show that we went to see.
It's awesome.
Like old, like 50s ambulance. It was so cool looking.
The funny thing for me about the punk rock stuff is, you know, I was into the DC stuff, and of course the Bad Brains started out in DC and then came to New York, and I also got into the New York crossover hardcore scene while I was in Washington. So I started really appreciating Agnostic Front and
Sick of It All, Cro-Mags,
absolutely. Biohazard were a little later, Sheer Terror.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, wow, this is almost like thrash metal. You know, SOD was a crossover band that a lot of guys in Anthrax had formed with Dan Looker, who was originally in Anthrax and went on to Nuclear Assault. But I had no idea what these guys were really like. I thought they're just like, you know, thrash metal dudes. They just drink and party and have fun. And writing this book was a real revelation to me that a lot of these guys were thugs. And, you know, they grew up on the streets and they were really living lifestyles that I couldn't have imagined, you know.
Right, I mean, you love the records, but we still went home to our regular house.
Yes, you're not stabbing people, opening a door and then, you know, reaching through and stabbing someone like happens to them.
The singer for DRI was living in a tree. He said one day after a tour with Slayer, they dropped him off in front of his tree. And they said, you're kidding. This isn't really. He's like, nope, this is where I'm staying now. He's like, you're.
And
the
I think
tree?
He said he felt safer up in the tree because
right.
He can't get to you.
Yeah, the derelicts were down below him, and the only thing that was running around him were squirrels. So
you know, I love when Richard Lloyd talks about the original Seabees and how there was like a hotel flop house on top of Seabees.
Right.
And people, urine would like leak through the ceiling onto the stage while the original bands were playing.
Oh,
like before,
wow.
Like all the glory, like, you know, the glory of the Seabees days, there was piss coming from the ceiling.
Mm.
Can you imagine?
And now it's John Varvatos. It would drip on those beautiful clothes, so I hope they cleared that up.
Even in the glory of the CBGB's days, you would never go into that bathroom and take a dump.
Oh,
because,
first of all,
it didn't have a door.
Yeah.
And you'd probably get tetanus if you sat down.
No, you would. It was unbelievable. We used to look at it and get scared. You know, we'd piss in the back alley there. It was classic. Even Chad Smith of the Chili Peppers was talking to me recently about it. Yeah, I pissed out here. And how many times did people piss in the back of that thing? It was incredible. The other thing was when you looked up, first of all, CBGB's had one of the greatest sound systems of all time.
Yeah.
It sounded incredible. And before people could do home recording or bands that couldn't afford to make their own demos, they would tape their sets at CB's because they would just sound
live at
as close
yeah.
as you could get.
And Tommy Victor from Prong was doing the sound for a lot of those albums.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Tommy's great.
Yeah.
I love Prong. Snap your fingers, snap your neck.
That's absolutely.
That's not the best song. I used to listen to that every morning. I'd be like, this is, it gets you.
I don't know. Beg to Differ does it for me a little more. Beg to Differ does it a little bit more for me.
Yeah. But snap your fingers, snap your neck.
One of my top five favorite songs.
Great song.
And even just the humor in the title.
Yeah.
Too, like snap your fingers.
And then even the stuff he did in Ministry was just amazing. I mean, Tommy's a great player.
There's so many people that are in here. Even Trent Reznor, Marilyn Manson.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's so much stuff.
Killing Joke.
Killing Joke, who I love. I saw
Rammstein.
Let me tell you, I saw Killing Joke. Speaking about a band who looked pretty scary in the beginning.
Right.
I remember seeing them at City Gardens. John Stewart, of course, was the bartender back there from Daily Show. And I remember going upstairs and hanging out with Killing Joke as a kid. And they were the first band who turned me on to like hip hop and rap because they had a boombox with The Message by Grandmaster Flash. I'd heard
wow.
other stuff.
Awesome.
But that was the first song that made me go, wow, this is cool shit.
Uh-huh.
So they were dancing around with a bottle of Jack, sharing it to The Message by Grandmaster Flash, which made me fall in love with it. So I bought that on Sugar Hill Records, and then Message to New York, New York, and then White Lines. At
White Lines.
Quadruple
oh
four great singles that they made
mm-hmm.
in a row. But isn't that funny? The Killing Joke were the
wow.
ones of all bands.
Well, they were really an important band.
And
I mean,
covered by, you know, obviously huge
sure.
influence on Dave Grohl. Metallica covered them, mm-hmm. you know, yep. Garage Days. So, you know, you've got all that.
Yeah,
what
I mean,
a great band.
Metal has tendrils everywhere.
Yeah, but I think they were the first band that really made industrial metal sort of a label, even though they weren't calling it that, and nobody else was at the time. But they laid the foundation for Ministry and for Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson. You know, the
KMFDM and all the sure. Last Track stuff.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
What do you see in metal with metal right now? Where do you see metals? You know what? I'm bummed because we never really got to Priest. I kind of wanted to talk about Judas Priest and mention that I saw Priest's first concert in New York City, opening for Stars and REO Speedwagon.
Awesome.
And I went there to see Stars, S-T-A-R-Z.
Attention Shoppers.
Yeah, you know, it was actually the Violation record, their first two albums.
Yeah,
they were
right.
Managed by Bill Alcoin, who managed Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I saw their album on some, like, Cream or Circus magazine,
right.
So I bought it. So I went to check them out. It was like a $2 show, and there's this band opening. No Leather yet. 2 feet on the front of the stage to play Sin After Sin. So, and then they came back like a year later and did Stained Glass.
Class.
Yeah. Let's say, I'm sorry. Yes. You know, it's like corrected myself. Stained Class. And that was the
they were
pun.
Probably in their like floaty hippie outfits.
Yeah,
and
not,
right.
Not
high heel shoes.
Still.
Okay.
It wasn't like those early footage of them doing stuff from Sad Wings of Destiny or Rock and
yeah.
Roll
actually,
on English TV.
There's some
actually,
great.
It was before Leather. And mm-hmm. There's rumors that, you know, that the guy. The one guy in Stars was the one who got Rob into the Leather scene a bit. What do you guys think?
Well, Rob said it was going around the...
New York City, Lower East Side, right?
No, he actually said it was... I thought it was New York, but then looking back at the book, he said it was going around the London, you know, S&M clubs.
Yeah.
And he said he really thought... basically, Glenn had taken... it was either, it might have been KK, but one of them was wearing a black leather... jacket during a rehearsal. He thought, that looks really tough. That looks cool. Let me expand upon that. And Rob is a very artistic and creative guy. So he's like, well, where can I find like really intense leather and cool looking biker type stuff? I know. I'll look around the S&M shops in London. And so he got whips and he got chains and all sorts of various accoutrements.
He was helping
brought him
leather.
To the band.
Yeah.
And overnight, transformed the look of this band and the look of metal, really, because there's so many bands from the new wave of British heavy metal.
Even Motorhead, in
yeah.
many ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's
sure.
be honest with you. Motorhead's yeah. look was
No Life to Leather, yeah.
There you know? Was...
Denim and Leather brought us all together.
Sure. I love Motorhead and Ace of Spades still. Doesn't that still sound
though,
great?
Though
every
I must
time
say,
you hear it?
Lemmy says they are not metal. Lemmy says Motorhead's not metal. You know, he's like, well, you know, kind of a speeded up blues band. That sounded more like Ozzy, but you get
hey,
the
regardless,
picture.
We got the idea that, you know, you're talking about a British guy.
Yeah,
Lemmy.
I mean, obviously, you know, there's Ronnie James Dio who embraces metal. There's Rob Halford, self-proclaimed metal god. And then mm-hmm. there's Lemmy who's like, eh, Motorhead's not metal, but, you know, just we're playing loud.
Well, Geezer Butler said that when he first heard his Black Sabbath called heavy metal, he was bummed out because... The term didn't exist as far as he knew, and all he could think about was somebody dropping a bunch of trash can lids on the ground and the clashing noise that it would make.
He
and,
wasn't thinking of Mars Bonfire.
No heavy metal thunder. No
metal.
William Burroughs or
Burroughs, right? Yeah,
yeah. But
Naked Lunch and all.
Well, so no, I mean, you'd asked us about the future of metal,
and
Louder Than Hell had to, you know, we had to end the book at a certain point. Metal's going to go on, but I mean. Who's the very most current band in the book?
Is well, we end the book with Slipknot, and I think it's an appropriate place because Slipknot were really important in bringing metal to a new audience and in a new direction after nu metal. They took little bits of nu metal, but then they incorporated it with thrash and death metal and pop and industrial and just frenetic percussion, added this insane performance art style image, and somehow created these really melodic tunes. What I love is when these bands come along that you're like, this could not be played on the radio. This is absurd. Bands
now,
like Tool.
Or, started getting played.
Yeah.
You know,
Tool, System of a Down. There's all these bands that really
great
aren't
band.
Commercial. But they transcend and they're able to break that that wall down. And I think Slipknot did that. And along with them, you have bands like Mastodon and Lamb of God. And to me, that's really what's happening now. And these are the new bands that'll be around 20 years from now. So we ended the book right around that sort of new American metal scene, as they call it. You know, there are newer bands like Asking Alexandria and Black Veil Brides.
Ghost, of course,
and,
has a
sure.
big
ghost
physical.
You don't turn me on a ghost was Duff McKagan, of course.
But they sound like they're from the 70s. So
yeah, exactly.
It all goes full circle.
Without all their masks and stuff, he said they looked like they were total indie. indie rock band.
Oh, really?
You know what I mean? Yeah, so that's what he was telling me all about.
Oh, you have to wear a mitre on stage. Yeah.
Well, they're just a bunch of Swedes who used to be in, you know, early melodic death metal bands. So
I thought you were going to say they were, like, writing songs for Britney Spears. And
oh, no. No Milli Vanilli syndrome here. They're true to the spirit of metal, and King Diamond was a, you know, an icon and hero for them. And but, yeah, it's just, it's interesting how when you take it to the very end, even those guys look back at the legends of the industry with just reverence and respect and awe, and the way, you know, the guy from Five Finger Death Punch, Ivan Moody, reacted to working with Rob Halford on the new Five Finger Death Punch album.
Yeah,
you know,
he's great. I mean, Ivan's such a cool guy. I was on Shiprock, this cruise that I co-hosted, and he was there, and we had quite a good time. But guys, I want to thank you for coming by. We're out of time, unfortunately, because there's so much to talk about. John Wiederhorn, Catherine Turman. The book is Louder Than Hell, The Definitive Oral History of Metal, and it's an incredible book. And it's 700 pages, but believe me, you will get your money's worth. Guys, it was so great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having us.
I mean, it's always a pleasure to talk with you and hang out.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was fun hanging with you, and we'll do it again sometime.
And keep the book in your bathroom, because you never know when... You can just flip through a few pages
like
and move on.
My reading glasses, man. I ain't getting any younger, baby. You know?
Believe me, know the feeling. Thanks for having us.
Guys, great to have you. It's the Hivecast.
This has been the Hivecast with Matt Pinfield. For all things music, news, interviews, live events, and more, go to mtvhive.com.